Well, brothers and sisters, I feel I'm starting this evening with what in some circles would be called a handicap of three. First problem being that when Brother John Hamnett called me in the spring, he said, we'd like you, if you could, to talk about something topical. And I said, how am I to know what's going to be topical in November? And then I thought for a moment and I said, well, in view of the fact that Britain were now assuming the presidency of the European Community, we could expect something pretty acrimonious to happen. The second handicap I have is nobody likes the guy who said, there you are, I told you so. But here we are, meeting now some 6 weeks after the devaluation of the pound, after Britain pulling out of the European monetary system. So please be assured that what we're looking at this evening is not a response to Black Wednesday of September the 16th, but rather something which sooner or later, brothers and sisters, was inevitable. It was going to happen. What we have to admit very frankly is we really had no idea how it was going to happen, nor indeed exactly when. But here we are now with John Major, our Prime Minister, facing potentially the greatest crisis in his life. Shall we or shan't we go into Europe or come out of it, or really, roughly, whereabouts do we stand? Now, the third problem is the difficulty in dealing with a subject like this, because unlike other nations in prophecy, you don't read about Britain in those terms, or America or the Commonwealth. You do, of course, read about Lebanon, you read about Kush or Sudan, you read about Egypt, you read about Persia or Iran. You read in a very thinly veiled way, of course, about this great confederacy in the north. Syria equals Russia. You don't have to work very hard to understand and accept that the Ottoman Empire, the Turkish people, are identified in prophecy. But when we come to Britain, we're dealing with a very dynamic sort of situation. By that I mean, we should have learnt over the last year or two to be very careful how we identify powers in prophecy. That is, look at the map of Europe. For example, 2 years ago we had two Germanies. We now have one. 18 months ago we had one Russia. And I was brought up in the days of Joe Stalin and Bulganin and people like this. I knew there was only one Russia. Now we have 15. So when we talk about Russia, which of 15 Russias do we mean? Matter of fact, when I first read Elpis Israel, the preference to it, I got a little irritated by these references to the leader of Russia being the autocrat of all the Russias. Why so? Because there was only one Russia. But now we see, brothers and sisters, we're right back to where we were 100 or so years ago with 15 Russias. 12 months ago, we had one Yugoslavia. We've now got 2.5, maybe more. So you see, we've got a very dynamic subject to look at where we have to be a little bit careful about how we identify a nation according to what period of God's dispensation we're looking at. Now, why take time anyway to look at the subject at all? Well, there are the two classical reasons of why I study prophecy. Not so that we can predict cleverly what will happen next year, next month, or so on, but so that we may know where we stand today. So that when we look at what's going on in the world around us, that we might be able to know where we stand in relation to that for which we pray, the return of Christ to this earth. And the second reason is so that we may testify to our friends of that coming to pass on the earth, to testify to the way, as Brother Paul has said, to the visible hand of God at work in the nations. And if, brethren and sisters, we cannot see the hand of God at work in the nations for the last 2 years, will we ever? Because there has been so much there for us to see. And so then, this is an old-fashioned subject, isn't it? Let's be quite clear. I've not come here to represent simply the ideas of our 19th century brethren. No. Rather do I want you and invite you to challenge them. I invite you to question them and say, well, are the things that the Christadelphian community always have been talking about, are they sound? And I'm absolutely convinced that if you do so honestly, and if I can handle this evening correctly, I'm quite convinced you should go away from here utterly persuaded that those things which we were pleased to preach about for the last 150 years, are indeed true. So it's in that spirit, if you like, that I want to approach this subject tonight. But before doing so, we have to define what our subject will be. You cannot, in giving a title, make it too long. It's long enough as you see it, goes right across the page. Let me say straight away, in the spirit of what I said, of identifying powers at any given time, we will see how this power that we call Britain, this power that is identified as Tarshish, I believe, in the Bible, has varied down the ages. And so then, unashamedly and quite sensibly, I think we want to define what we're going to talk about, and that is about Britain, the American power, the Commonwealth, the Western Alliance, the English-speaking nations, if you like. But another way of putting it will be Tarshish then, now, and in the future. Well, it's an enormous subject. Only those brethren who've had to set about explaining it and dealing with it will know the complexities involved. So let me tell you, first of all, what we're not going to talk about. We will not this evening deal with what is known amongst us as Eastern Tarshish. You're very happy to talk in any Bible class about it. It's not a difficult problem, but it just isn't relevant to what we want to talk about tonight. Nor am I going to talk about Tyre in any great detail, nor about Sheba and Dedan, because they're not Britain. They are Arabs, but please note, Arabs, not the Arabs. Tyre, let me just say, if we're going to get any real benefit out of it, does require full treatment for full value, and I had occasion to spend an hour or so the other Sunday night over at Shirley just dealing with the first part of that subject. The destruction of Tyre is an object lesson in how fulfilled prophecy can be a witness to the truth of the Bible. We can go to the Bible and say to our friends, look, God said this would happen. Here is the evidence that it did happen. Now, why do you hesitate to believe the rest of God's prophecies? It has a twofold witness too, that which we read of in Ezekiel. And although we can discuss these things, I believe also southern Lebanon forms a great element in Obadiah's prophecy of the last days. But the symbolic role and many of the characteristics of Tyre have, as the Bible tells us, been brought forward to Tarshish, been passed over to Tarshish. And so Tyre will become a type, if you understand what I mean, of Britain in the last days. We read about how Britain will sing as a harlot, how Britain eventually, as I hope to show you, will come to Christ and will contribute to the building of that temple, as indeed the people of Tyre did in the old days. So that's what we're not going to deal with. I know there's a tremendous amount there, but we want to concentrate on identifying Tarshish. Well, in these days of computerized Bibles, all you do, if you want to talk about Tarshish, you press a button, mark Tarshish, or on the screen, and lo and behold, out the other end of the computer comes all the quotes. I know you can't read it, but you see, it's as simple as that. If we're going to have a scripture-based evening on Tarshish, voila, there you are, press the button, and there are all the Bible references to Tarshish. Now, if we did that for Tyre, you would then have a printout of another three A4 size pieces of paper. In fact, if you stuck them all together, it would be as tall as me in print that size. So what we want to do then is try and define what our questions are. The big question is, who then, when we look at those biblical references to Tarshish, who is Tarshish? What does the Bible say about Tarshish? How does it describe Tarshish? And having done that, what clues does it give to the identity of Tarshish? The point being, as I said earlier, this is not one of these subjects where you can turn to a certain quotation and say, there you are, Tarshish is Britain. Doesn't say so at all. As we'll see in a moment, it is a subject which requires a certain amount of sleuthing, if you know what I mean. You've got to sit there and say, well, let's look at the evidence surrounding it. So what I want to do tonight is do the reverse of what most people do. I want to present to you my conclusions first. And I want to present, as it were, a challenge, a hypothesis, which invites you to test what I say against the scriptures and against the other evidence we present. So our conclusions are, and our proposition is, that Britain was the Tarshish power of give or take BC 500. Secondly, that the British Empire, as we used to call it, has fulfilled the biblical description and role of Tarshish in, say, the last 300 years. And the third proposition is that of all the nations in the world, it's pretty clear, I hope you'll agree, that Britain, the US, the Commonwealth, however you want to define this dynamic, moving situation, is the power to fulfil the role of Tarshish in the future. So, to put it a different way, why do I say so? What are the general conclusions? We could define it this way, that Britain, the USA, the Commonwealth, after all, where did the America come from? Where did the Commonwealth originate from? Has fulfilled, does fulfill, will fulfill the role of Tarshish. And why do we say that? Well, there are, in fact, give or take one or two, some 27 references to Tarshish in the Bible. There are, as I've already said, many more to Tyre. If you try and see these in the context of other scriptures, and then say, well, that's all right, but we still now have to look a little further, we've got to see what Tarshish was in the context of history, geography, and latterly current affairs. And then when you've done that, you still have to try and fit this together and see how it complies with the overall latter-day scheme of things. How does it fit into what the Bible tells us about the latter days? And in fact, God's plan for the ages too. Now, as part of my own studies, I tried to locate every published article in the Christadelphian, the Testimony, the Logos, Graham Pierce's Milestones, and also other magazines of a somewhat more critical disposition, shall we say. And there is the result of the articles on Tarshish in the last 15 years. Quite an amazing collection. Some of them, of course, are rather critical of the traditional view. Traditional, I think it's the best way of explaining and describing what I mean, that which Christadelphians have always believed. And so that traditional view, as you look through our literature, has come under a certain amount of criticism as being old-fashioned. The credibility has been challenged, even ridiculed. You don't really believe, do you, that Tarshish is a Victorian British imperial power? But it's never been, as far as I can see and locate, never been adequately replaced with anything that holds together and meets the requirement of the scriptures. What are the principal areas of objection, if we look at it? Because, remember, I'm not standing here simply repeating everything that was no doubt spoken in this hall 100 years ago, or 70 or 80 at least. I want you to say, hang on, wait a minute, John, you convinced me tonight that Britain is Tarshish. Well, one of the major areas of objection, if you like, is that we don't really know where Tarshish was, do we? So a lot of discussion centres around the difficulty of locating Tarshish. Then there's another problem, which you will have seen, ironically, in today's Telegraph and also on the back of this little leaflet, the reference to the lions of Tarshish. Were they lions? Is our authorised text sound? Or really should we not do what the RSV says and regard them as villages? If you do, of course, you have a very different situation. If you can't, therefore, argue scripturally in those areas, then let's try and undermine the evidence that's used. And some people have said, well, look, the arguments on which you base, or the evidence on which you base your views about Tarshish are rather shifty grounds, aren't they? Let's look at them. Then there's an accusation that really you're just a lover of nostalgic imperialism, that you're very proud of Britain. Well, brothers and sisters, those of us who have had to stand up in public before a military service tribunal and profess that we have no loyalty to the king and empire, it's a little hard when people say you have a romantic, nostalgic feeling for the past when Britain once had an empire. And then latterly there have been the sort of views that say, well, really those back-end chapters of Ezekiel are not for us anyway. Now, I don't intend spending any time on that subject, because there's an excellent article by Tony Benson in the Current Testament, to which I would refer you. So then, we won't deal with those, but we will, and we have to, spend a little time to find out about the location of Tarshish. And so then, turn your Bible, please, and see what the Bible tells us about the description of Tarshish. How does the Bible describe Tarshish? We've got to find out, not just running through a whole set of quotes, but what does, and in what terms, does the Bible describe Tarshish? Well, what I've asked Paul to do is read the readings for me. It's a bit of a twist going from that bright light over here. So Paul's going to just read Genesis 10, 4 to 5. Where do we first read about Tarshish? And there's that old rule, isn't there, of Christadelphian Bible Exposition. Look up where the word is first used, stop and consider if there are any clues there. Genesis 10, 4 and 5.
And the sons of Javan, Elisha, and Tarshish, Kittim, and Dodanim, by these were the isles of the Gentiles divided in their lands, every one after his tongue, after their families in their nations.
And they went forth and became a maritime power. So Javan is the word, if you like, for Greece. It's translated in our Old Testament five times as Greece. There's no doubt about that. Look on the old maps. And we know that we're dealing with a geographic power. Now turn to Jonah chapter 1, a story that you know very well. We all know the story about Jonah, the big fish, what he was trying to do. But what does Jonah tell us about Tarshish?
Jonah chapter 1 and verse 1. Now the word of the Lord came unto Jonah, the son of Amittai, saying, Arise, go to Nineveh, that great city, and cry against it, for their wickedness is come up before me. But Jonah rose up to flee unto Tarshish, from the presence of the Lord, and went down to Joppa, and he found a ship going to Tarshish. So he paid the fare thereof, and went down into it, to go with them unto Tarshish, from the presence of the Lord.
So, never mind what Jonah's mission was, what we do know about Jonah was, he was trying very hard to get away from the Lord. Now I put it to you, if you believe, if it's possible, as maybe Jonah did, that if you get away from the Lord, or at least the Lord's country, what would he do? Pop down to Joppa and take a coaster up to Haifa? End up at restarting the Lord's land. No. If Jonah wanted to get away from the Lord and not go ahead with that mission to go eastwards, what would he do? He'd get down a boat and get as far away as he possibly could. So we read that he just goes down and he gets aboard the boat with a view to getting away from the Lord or the Lord's country. But the Lord says to him, boy, I've got a job for you to do. You can't get away from me like that. So this evidently quite large boat is out there, and we know the rest of the story. Don't worry about the story of Jonah, but only about what it tells us by implication about Tarshish. If you want to get away from the Lord, you don't just pop around the corner, you get away as far as possible. And the story goes on in chapter 4, but we'll just pass over to Isaiah chapter 2, which we won't look at because we'll come back to that later. If we had time to look at Isaiah 2 at this stage, we would discover that Tarshish, whoever Tarshish is, now please, keep an open mind. Keep an open mind. What has the Bible told us so far? It told us that it's maritime people. They went abroad and made their living by being maritime people. And it's a long way, evidently, from the Lord's country. Isaiah 2 tells us it's a maritime power, but if you now turn to 2 Chronicles chapter 9, again, please keep an open mind. Where do you think Tarshish is? It's down to me to try and persuade you this evening. So, as we assemble the Bible evidence, Paul, 2 Chronicles 9, 21 to 22,
For the king's ships went to Tarshish with the servants of Huram every 3 years. Once came the ships of Tarshish, bringing gold and silver, ivory and apes and peacocks. And King Solomon passed all the kings of the earth in riches and wisdom.
Right. Wherever Tarshish was, it was a long way. It took a long time to get there. It could be a 3 year round trip. Don't know where it was, because the Bible hasn't told us where it was. But again, we know that this power of Tarshish was a maritime power, went on long sea journeys. Psalm 72, the most read chapter on Sunday nights, which we'll come back to in a moment, so don't turn to it now, does tell us that it's an island power associated with islands. So turn, if you would, to the key chapter, Ezekiel 27. Because when you come to Ezekiel 27, you have this judgment of God upon Tyre. Now, here is a key chapter that we can turn to and say, look, the Lord said this would happen to Tyre, and it did happen with amazing detail, accuracy, and therefore we can believe in Bible prophecy. But if we look at Ezekiel 27, verse 12, we see this reference to Tarshish. Now, Tarshish, at this great imperial trading centre of Tyre, Tarshish was a merchant by reason of a multitude of all kinds of riches. Now, here are the goodies that Tarshish dealt in: silver, iron, tin, and lead. And they were the goodies that Tarshish dealt with in the marketplace of Tyre. It goes on, of course, in that chapter to describe some of the other market traders. There were those who dealt in wood, there were those who dealt in horses and horsemen. And so Tyre was a great marketplace. But then we come to verse 25, and we read of how the ships of Tarshish did sing of thee in thy market, and thou wast replenished, and made very glorious in the midst of the seas. Tyre, we all know, don't we, was an island, and it was only when Alexander the Great came down and put the rocks out of the land, made that great breakwater, that it became a peninsula. Well, you might say, it hasn't told us very much. That doesn't tell you that Tarshish is great. No, I agree. What does it tell us? Well, they were traders with Tyre, which exists, from a distance. Well, think about it. If they come in a boat, you don't have to have super intelligence to realise if you come in a boat to Tyre, near Beirut, you must have come from the west. You couldn't have come overland from the east. I'll show you why I say strong on shipping with large boats in a moment. But undoubtedly the source of silver, iron, tin and lead. Alright? We still don't know where Tarshish is. So let's have a go at speculating. Let's make one important point, however, that nowhere do you read of reaching Tarshish by land. Just sort of cue that little detail up for a moment. Because where, then, is Tarshish? We haven't answered that question. Well, what did Josephus say? Josephus said that it was where it came from, Cilicia. Josephus said it's Tarsus. Hang on, that doesn't square with all that description of boats, does it? Alright, no. Well, another word for Tarshish, I'm told by those who are clever in these things, is that it simply means a hard or an enduring thing. So a ship of Tarshish would be a big boat capable of enduring long journeys. So, John, that doesn't prove anything. Alright? No problem. What else might it be? Well, another idea, which my two brethren have embraced, is that Lebanon was nothing, really. It was just sort of a customer of Tyre. You could say that Tarshish was little more than southern Lebanon. Or there are those who would say, if you completely know those who are totally clever in languages and so on, would say that Tarshish, if you look it up in a Bible dictionary, is a Phoenician word from the Akkadian meaning smelting plant or refinery. So that's all Tarshish is. Any place that has a smelting furnace. So, is that so? Does that fit with all those other things we've just read about Tarshish? Well, then there are two other ideas which Willoughby engage our attention today. And that is that Tarshish was Spain, or Tarshish was Britain. Now, why does it matter? Why about it? Well, there's one important reason. Firstly, of course, if we can locate Tarshish and be certain about it, then we are given a very great preaching aid. Secondly, we are given that ability to know where we stand in relation to the end times. But there is one other important reason, brothers and sisters, and that is very simply this, that in order to justify alternative modern views about Armageddon and the end times, it is terribly important to dispose of Britain. As a truth, Tarshish is only Spain. Now, we'll see the importance of that later, bearing in mind. Why is it important to some to prove that Tarshish is not, has nothing to do with the British Empire? Well, the reason is, if you can get rid of Britain, you're then free to adopt some modern views, let's call them that, about Armageddon. Now, there is something, of course, in favour of Spain. It was to the west. It was a long sea journey away. Certainly the Phoenicians and the Tyrian traders got there, there's no doubt about that. And no doubt some metals there as well. Show you one example of that moment. But so much of it hangs upon the identification of the word Tartessus. It was in Spain, a place called Tartessus, therefore some say, for clever languages, that is Tarshish. If you ring up the Spanish tourist office and say, excuse me, Adam, I'm doing a research project in Spain and I want to go and see Tartessus. What answer do you get? Where's that? Well, I don't know. I'm asking you. I don't know. Well, I have to ask somebody and come back to you. Of course, I never do. So, it is important, therefore, that we ask ourselves the question, where do you go for one-stop shopping in silver, iron, tin and lead? Well, possibly from Tartessus in Spain, yes. That is quite true. If you go to Granada or Seville or Cordoba and you rent a car and you drive down to Monte Gordo in the Algarve in southern Spain, what do? You drive down towards Gibraltar, and there on the left is the enormous works of the Rio Tinto Zinc Corporation. But as you look around searching for evidence of silver, iron, tin and lead, the big four metals, evidence gets a bit scarce. But nonetheless, one does concede the Phoenicians got there, it is west of Tyre, it is a long way by boat, and there was metal there of some sort or another. Possibly, of course, some metal came from Cyprus. For Cyprus is only another way of talking about the Cuprus Island, the Copper Island, and we know within church that Tarshish's brother was Kittim. And Kittim is the biblical word for Cyprus. Now think of it for a moment, that fits quite sensibly. You pick up a load of zinc from the forerunners of the Rio Tinto Zinc Corporation in southern Spain. You go back, pick up a load of copper in Cyprus, and what do you have? Brass, jadeite, brazen coated brick, all fits together a bit, doesn't it, with lead image. But undoubtedly, of course, the metals came from the tin islands, except that hasn't stopped it. Well, I seem to recall from my O-level chemistry that the word for tin ore is cassiterite. Well, the Greeks knew that, and they called the tin islands, wherever the tin islands were, and we haven't proved anything, they just simply called them the Cassiterides Islands. Now, the funny thing is that the Phoenicians had a word for those islands too, and they called them the Baratanic Islands. And then when you read all the books about philology, if that's the right word, the meanings of words, they then say, well, interesting thing of the origin of language is that same word in Celtic is Britannic or Britannia. Well, you may say, you're making it easy for yourself, John, relying, you know, John, you don't think about these languages. I'm a good at Phoenician. How are you, brother? Is it Phoenician? Italian? So you have to turn to Smith's Bible Dictionary. Now this is something which I think is in many Christadelphian libraries, and is a reference book which is used to say, ah, well, Smith's Bible Dictionary, if you can see the small print up there, says probably review of these passages, it will be seen that not one of them furnishes proof that Tarshish and Tartessus were the same cities. A German gentleman wrote in 1850 that he applied it to Italy. But he did agree that most people at the time applied it to Tartessus, but he said the etymology is uncertain. Now look what we're saying. Even the experts don't agree on the wording. They can't agree that Tarshish equals Tartessus. Herodotus seems to be one of those sources that Christadelphians quote when it supports their view and criticise when it doesn't. Pardon me sounding a little bit hard-boiled, but please notice that Herodotus on this occasion notes how Tartessus was placed beyond the Pillars of Hercules, which is Gibraltar. Whoops. If you go to Spain and you look for where the Rio Tinto's ink corporation is and the metal was supposed to be, it was east of Gibraltar. Now, this book is saying it's to the west, and it talks about a river Tartessus, but they couldn't find one on the map when they looked for it. Diodorus mentions, indeed, that some tin was imported into Gaul from Britain and was then conveyed on horseback across France, the port of Marseille, and taken by the traders' boats to Phoenicia. So you see, one of the main sources of information that is used, and it's in one of these magazines that have been published fairly recently, is an unreliable source. So you pop around the local library, get out Encyclopedia Britannica, and I don't think my local librarian likes me. I tend to pose all questions. I said I want evidence of where Tartessus was. And what do you read? The Tartessians, whoever they were by this time sailing the Atlantic southwards down the African coast, and possibly back at the other side, which is why eastern Tarshish becomes a subject for discussion, and to the northeastern part of the peninsula, that's towards France, and to the Cassiterides Islands, brackets, silly islands, interesting, isn't it? The exact location of Tartessus has yet to be established, and even the ancient writers themselves are in doubt about it. Well, I don't think we need be in doubt about it, brothers and sisters, because if you went out to find the tin islands, go the way the Phoenicians evidently did, and of course they set out and come westwards out of Tyre across this long journey. Now, this may be where Jonah was hoping to get to. He wanted to get away from the Lord's country, and so he sets out and comes out here, and you turn right through the Pillars of Hercules, and go northwards up to these islands, which the Greeks called the Cassiterides. Only to find, of course, that lo and behold, the metals have been being taken across France. And of course, the thing to do is to ridicule the idea of there ever being a serious tin business in this country. Well, the likes of you and I, brothers and sisters, stumped up 25 million quid 5 years ago to save the Cornish tin industry. But one small detail which we won't divert to is St. Michael's Mound, Manor's Iron. Just interesting that one connection among many between Israel and Britain is to be found in Cornwall, where the tin mines are located, the name of the village, Mara's Iron. It can be said, was traced back to the Roman destruction of Jerusalem when Jewish slaves were transported to work in the tin mines. The bitterness of Zion. Look, the Daily Telegraph, the Daily Mail, and the Financial Times are in no doubt about there being a metals industry in Cornwall. Gilmore Mine, 5,000 tonnes of tin in reserve, which at the annual production rate of 700 tonnes a year would provide work for the Cornish miners for many years to come. The only trouble is the price is all wrong. So the price of tin is what determined the closure. But here again, only last summer, £35 million project has been designed to save the 2,000-year-old tin mining industry. Hard rock mining has been carried out in Cornwall since Phoenician times and provided work for 50,000 men in 300 mines at its height in the 1860s. So no wonder, you see, 100 years ago, our brothers and sisters had no doubt, there was a huge metals industry in our own country. But, say some, what's the evidence that Phoenicians actually came here? Where can you dig up things and show Phoenician remains? Well, excuse me saying so, brothers and sisters, but the Phoenicians were traders. They didn't live here. They didn't stay here. They didn't build cities here. They may well have dug wells, square wells here, but that's a separate matter. All right, supposing you don't go to Cornwall, how about going up to Yorkshire for your holidays, to the Swaledale, to the Yorkshire Dales? And maybe you don't like history, but prefer James Herriot. And in his book on Yorkshire, you know, he's the guy who talks about all creatures great and small. When James Herriot went to Yorkshire, he was astonished. He felt a sense of shock and surprise when I came to Yorkshire and had no idea that the beautiful Pennine Valley, Swaledale in particular, were once the world centres of lead mining. Go and see for yourself in Swaledale or the Yorkshire Dales the remains of a great lead mining country. Now I'm told that people of Birmingham don't go to Yorkshire, they go to Llandudno or North Wales. Your grand sisters, if you go up to North Wales, pop into Anglesey and see what's going on up there. Now we're not talking about Victorian evidences, we're talking about how the Paris Mountain Project would produce 13,000 tonnes of zinc, lead, copper, and so on. So it goes on and on and on. You may say, well, this is anecdotal evidence or something, but competent authorities are in no doubt at all about an Anglo-Phoenician metals trade. In 1952, Brother Carter, and I'm grateful to Karen Dutton at the office for sending me a copy, produced an excellent article which is full of a bibliography saying here's what men really think about the Phoenicians coming to Britain. It's an enormous bibliography and worth looking at. But if you say again, yes, they're Christadelphians with a point to prove. Well, bring up the Institute of Metals, write to them like one sister did in our meeting and say, excuse me, could you tell me anything about metals industry in this country? And the Institute of Metals will write back and they will tell you, yes, this country did supply, could supply the big four metals, of which there's no actual evidence Spain ever did. Oh, well then, if that's not enough, get in touch with the Camborne School of Mines, we did, and you find again the tremendous evidence that you cannot disregard the fact the Phoenicians came here. Oh, where do you start? University of Hamburg did a study looking for Tartessus and couldn't find it. Rutgers University, Brother David Sutcliffe, who was with us last week, told me of his correspondence with this New York University, saying, why don't you come on over here and study the evidence that exists of how the Phoenicians came here. The Royal Institution of Thought. We could go on and on and on, showing that competent experts are in no doubt, no doubt at all, that the traders of Tyre and Tarshish created a metals business, not just in the Scilly Islands, but throughout this country. So what then, if you're satisfied that the evidence is there, what are the roles of, what did Byron tell us about the roles of Tarshish? Well, we've seen that Ezekiel 27 is an independent offshore trading nation. Isaiah 23, which we've not looked at, tells us that in the end it will take over as a latter-day Tyre. It will become a great marketplace like Tyre was. Isaiah 60, if you could just read that for us, Paul, tells us that it's going to, whoever Tarshish is, you may say I haven't proved it yet, you may still feel that obviously this is not Lebanon, this is not Turkey, but you may have a hankering thinking this is Spain. Well, Isaiah 60 verse 9,
surely the isles shall wait for me, and the ships of Tarshish first, to bring thy sons from far, their silver and their gold with them, unto the name of the Lord thy God, and to the Holy One of Israel, because he hath glorified thee.
Alright, turn back to Isaiah 51. Just to get the location of this, Isaiah 51, take verse 11 first, and then to verse 5.
Therefore the redeemed of the Lord shall return, and come with singing unto Zion, and everlasting joy shall be upon their head. They shall obtain gladness and joy, and sorrow and mourning shall fade away. Verse 5. My righteousness is near, my salvation is gone forth, and mine arms shall judge the people. The isles shall wait upon me, and on mine arm shall they trust.
we won't do so. It's a difficult verse to understand. And there's only one place I know that's ever given a satisfactory explanation of that, and you know exactly where that is, I think, in this Ecclesia Eureka Volume 2. And it's in Ministry of the Prophets by C.C. Walker. But let's not stop. Let's just remind ourselves, Psalm 48, the Western ships. Sorry, Psalm 48, verses 4 to 7. We're speaking now of the last day. Psalm 48, verses 1 to 4, and verse 7.
Great is the Lord, and greatly to be praised, in the city of our God, in the mountain of his holiness. Beautiful for situation, the joy of the whole earth is Mount Zion, on the sides of the north, the city of the great king. God is known in her palaces for a refuge. For though the kings were assembled, they passed by together. Verse 7. Thou breakest the ships of Tarshish with an east wind.
Well, there are many ways of understanding verse 7, concordant study with the east wind and things like that. What we're saying, whatever this power is, it's to be humble. And that's a thought that's echoed also in Isaiah, which we won't look at the moment. But as we read on, and take now somewhat, we're up to about 15 scriptures we've looked at out of the 27 in the computer printout, we learn that, and we'll come to this after the break, well, whoever Tarshish is, it has to challenge some northern host. Whoever Tarshish is, Psalm 72 tells us, will surrender to Christ. And so we have a question. Which nation is this? Because we've still not located a verse that says Tarshish is the British, the Anglo-Saxon people down the ages. No. We're getting, hopefully, to a situation where the evidence certainly shows that Tarshish did fit the role of, or Britain did fit the role of Tarshish as described in the Bible in the early days. So all we can say is, well, if that's how the Bible describes the role of Tarshish, what the job it has to do, let's just spend a minute or two quickly looking at the broad lines of British history. Now, in two or three minutes flat, all we want to do is remind ourselves of how this country was Protestant rather than papal. Is that relevant? Might see after the break. Remind ourselves that Nev's image, Western leg, of course, was centred onto Europe. Following the Reformation in Central Europe, this nation chose to remain independent or Protestant. Let's remind ourselves the Spanish Armada. The Vatican said to Philip of Spain, look, why don't you go and take over your sister-in-law's place up there in the Cassiterides Islands? We'll finance you. You get all the boats out. And no reason that it was not Francis Drake who beat the Spanish Armada. It was the Lord stepping in, as we know, with a strong wind. It was the time of 1688. William and Mary came to the throne and said, we'll have no more to do with papal Europe. And the Queen at her coronation made an oath saying, never again will I allow a Catholic to sit upon the throne of England. So she's in a fix, isn't she, at the moment. Can't retire for family reasons, and there's no way that she can allow anyone other than an Anglican to be upon the throne of England. All right, Britain is not a Christian country, no, but it is Bible-oriented. After all, this is the home of Wycliffe and Tyndale. Admittedly, they did some of their work on the continent. But nonetheless, it was this country that gave us the great Bible, the Welsh Bible and the King James Version. And that Bible, we have to concede, if you read widely enough, was read by many of the statesmen of the 19th century. Lord Shaftesbury allowed the Bible to influence his judgments about what to do in the Middle East. If you read the biography of Disraeli, you will find he did exactly the same thing. Lord Balfour did his daily readings, I don't know according to which plan, in the Foreign Office in the early part of this century. If you read about these men, you may not say, well, they were Christians that we would approve of. The fact remains, unlike the continental politicians, they allowed the Bible to influence them. And that, I think, we can say quite enthusiastically. But think of it again, Britain is essentially a trading nation, essentially maritime. Fact of life, isn't it? But people say, oh, but it's not a great nation. But then, brothers and sisters, neither was Tarshish. Tarshish was nothing compared to Egypt, to Assyria, and the nations that they were contemporary with. So the fact that Britain no longer appears to rule the waves or dominate world commerce is irrelevant. But here's the point. Latterly, however, the Lord in his wisdom, I do believe, has enabled us to discover oil and gas, because the definition of England always used to be, when I was at school, a lump of coal surrounded by fish. Coal has now been liquidated. But does it not strike you as amazing that this country can be independent of oil and gas? Does it not strike you as equally amazing, brothers and sisters, that the continent of Europe depends for its gas on Russia? And I put that, when I drew that 18 months ago, first of all, I put in down there ERM AQ, you know, European Currency Units. I didn't know. Forgive me if I say there you are, I told you so, but why did I put that in? Because you know there's a Bundesbank that now has paused, basically, the devaluation. Have you seen that advertisement for the Deutsche Bank Group? If you want to talk big to somebody about European currency, if you'd like to deal with the global leader in European currency units, come on in, folks, come to the Deutsche Bank, and we will talk to you about a European currency unit with Charlemagne's head on. So we can see how Britain really has all the time been marking out a course of its own. It was dragged into the Middle East. It wasn't love of the Jews that took Britain into the Middle East, but rather because of the Industrial Revolution and Britain's empire, we had to go into the Middle East. We were dependent on the Far East, India, for raw materials and markets. So that is why the British government found itself in opposition to Russia in the Crimean War. I used to do this until about 3 months ago when they changed the pound note. Remember the old £10 note? Remember whose image and superscription was on the back? It was Florence Nightingale. What on earth has Florence Nightingale got to do her image on the back of a £10 note until they changed it with our study tonight? Only this. Every time you put one face downwards on the Tesco counter, you have a reminder of how Britain was there in Istanbul, in the eastern leg of the Nebuchadnezzar's empire image, if you like. What was Florence Nightingale doing in Istanbul at Scutari? Opposing the onrush of Russia into the holy places of Jerusalem. In Cyprus, how did it come by Cyprus? Well, it was because Disraeli said, look, we will prop up Turkey in order to keep Russia out of the Middle East, and in return, if you don't mind, we'd like to have Cyprus. So we took Cyprus off the Turks in 1877. And then, of course, you come to the story you know very well about how Britain got into the Middle East, because 1 month's time, the Khedive of Egypt was broke. He needed 4 million quid. He said, OK, I'll sell the shares. Got in touch with Disraeli through a bit of investigative journalism, as it's called today, who in touch contacted Lord Rothschild. And the story is gripping, but of course we bought an interest in Egypt. So it was, as Brother Thomas said, in 1848, 30 years before it happened, he said, look, I don't know whether the men who are present contrived the foreign policy of Britain, entertain the idea of assuming sovereignty of the Holy Land and promoting its colonisation by the Jews, but their present intentions are of no importance one way or the other, because they will be compelled by events soon to happen to do what, under existing circumstances, heaven and earth could not move them to attempt. The finger of God has indicated a course, and he's saying this in 1848, the Crimean War hasn't even started. Russia is beginning to emerge on the scene. And the Suez Canal hasn't even been finished. He says, pursued by Britain, which cannot be evaded, and which her counsellors will not only be willing, but eager to adopt when the crisis comes upon them. The decree has long since gone forth, which calls upon the Lion of Tarshish to protect the Jews. So very quickly, what did he say? 30 years before it happened, he could see that Britain would have to move into Europe to protect its own investment. What was Britain's mission and its reward? Well, to go into Egypt to protect its investment. Very convenient for God's timetable. Revelation 16. The Lord has said, the time will come when the drying up of the river Euphrates will come to pass. And to assist that process, of course, Britain was there. Ezekiel 37, the start of the return of the Jews. And so, very conveniently, humanly speaking, but no doubt arranged, I'm quite certain, by the Lord, General Allenby finds himself in Jerusalem, in Cairo, and then in 1917 marches into Jerusalem. Or, you might say, subject for prophetic discussion on the time periods of Daniel and elsewhere. But what do we read? Paul, turn to Isaiah 43, verses 1, 3, 6. What did Britain get for its work in helping the Jews to return to the land? Just have a look, Isaiah 43.
Verse 1. But now thus saith the Lord that created thee, O Jacob, and he that formed thee, O Israel, fear not, for I have redeemed thee. I have called thee by thy name. Thou art mine. Verse 3. For I am the Lord thy God, the Holy One of Israel, thy Saviour. I gave Egypt for thy ransom, Ethiopia and Seba for thee. Verse 6. I will say to the north, give up, and to the south, keep not back. Bring my sons from far, and my daughters from the ends of the earth.
So then, part of God's plan for restoring his people to the earth, Britain, you might say, coincidentally, you might say that. But Britain finds itself in pursuit of its own material interests of trade, its overseas business, find itself very conveniently in the Middle East, ready to liberate Jerusalem from the Ottoman, followed by the declaration, the Balfour Declaration. Instead, have you ever thought of it this way? One of the best returns on investment I know of in British industry was when Lord Rothschild over lunch in the City of London put up £4 million to the Israeli, who went away, bought the shares, and what was it, 30 years later? Lord Balfour, we're going to address our intention to make a home for the Jews to you. Interesting, isn't it? Why did Lord Balfour write to Rothschild? Because he put the money up in the first place, wasn't it? You may say this is rather hard-boiled, but this is very typical, isn't it, of this country as a trading nation. And so then, Egypt, and General Gordon at Khartoum, you know the story. But as our brethren of those days made absolutely clear, and if you want to have a... There's a 100-year-old book that I've still got to put home. It's falling apart fast. It's how Brother Roberts, in 1882, that's over 100 years ago, comments on what has happened in the last 30 years and what we can expect to happen. And lo and behold, outlines the role of Britain. We know how it came in charge of a mandate in 1920 and then gave up that mandate in time for the State of Israel to be created exactly on schedule, on time, as God had ordained. Do we really believe Genesis 12, verse 3? I will bless them that bless thee. Can you not sit down one evening and trace the history of this country to see when we blessed Israel, this country was blessed? When we cursed Israel, this country was blessed? And I don't... when we cursed Israel, this country was cursed. I don't really see, is it the Jerusalem Post that reminded us of what happened to David Mellor? Interesting. All the way down from Lord Carrington, the truth of that prophecy is being revealed. If you have time to read it, there's a book. It's rather criticised by some brethren who say, well, who was Barbara Cushman? You can get it at Christian Elkin's office. But a remarkable testimony to how Britain fulfilled that role, that vague description that we have of the role of Tarshish. Now, if we said, look, Tarshish, without any doubt, was the sort of place that is referred to in Ezekiel 27, it seems to us that Britain did in fact fulfill that role concerning the Jews over the years. Let me ask you a question. Supposing you're very anxious to get rid of Britain as difficulty in proving the Tarsus location. Some slight difficulty in proving that it does, capable of, supplying the big four metals. We've seen that Tarshish is described as something to do with islands and offshore power. Tarshish appears to be, from Genesis 10 onwards, an independent trading nation. Certainly, our history as a nation in the last 300 years has been positive towards the Jews. No doubt about that. But hang on, who was it who ran the Inquisition? Spain. Who were the first targets of the Spanish Inquisition? The Jews. And who was it who went to America with Christopher Columbus in 1492? Why, a boatload of Jews. So, you can't say in any way that Spain fills that role. Have the Spanish people aided and assisted the return of the Jews? Although this anticipates our second half, where were the Jews in 1854 when Britain was trying to keep Russia out of the Middle East because the time had not yet come for Ezekiel 38 to be fulfilled? Where was Spain in 1917 when this country was issuing the Balfour Declaration, when Russia was busy having a revolution, three-quarters of whose leaders were Jews? What was Spain doing? It was worrying itself about the appearance of the Virgin Mary on the hillside at Fatima in Portugal. You want to read what the Virgin Mary is alleged to have said, because we know it didn't happen, to those children. So it was looking the other way, wasn't it? And to mention there the Gulf War is to anticipate our second half. So here we are then. Who is Tarshish? The Bible doesn't tell you. You have to sort this out and say what fits. Here's the checklist to help you decide and identify who Tarshish is. First of all, concern yourself with history. Now, you may say that you don't like the idea of Britain being Tarshish. Well, what nation do you have in mind? How does it fit the needs of geography that we've looked at? The needs of religion? Its trading background? Is it an island power or associated with islands? What's its attitude to Israel? What's its relation to papal Europe? And does it have, as we'll see in the second half, the ability to oppose Russia? Would any of those nations do you? What about China? Big nation, you know, it's on the up and up, isn't it? How about Japan? Well, Japan is an island country, isn't it? And I suppose you could, in a manner of speaking, say if you went right the way round and came back the other side, you could get there by going west. But no, come on, be serious. Spain? What about Iran? Iran? Pro-Jewish? Brazil? Brazil, I am told, is a corruption of Hebrew words and has something to do with L. I'm not sure about that, but Germany? Norway, Argentina, you name it, brothers and sisters. Which country of your choice fits those needs? You see, in order to identify Tarshish, brothers and sisters, we've got to find a party in a nation which is west of Israel. What have we been reading about? Of the Isles, an island power in the uttermost parts in relation to Israel. Certainly a power that is a long way from Israel. A multinational market trader. A maritime trader. A nation that's had a strong metals business. That's been pro-Jewish. Assists in the regathering of the Jews. And a nation that somehow or other will surrender to Christ. Can you think of one? Think of what possible power that would be. Because in my judgment, if this is not Britain, then which nation is it?